I'm Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing. Generally, the actors I idolize are the greats of the past. I like some younger ones, I respect them. They're just not on my Mount Rushmore like Kirk Douglas or Barbara Stanwyck. One of the few current actors who tempts me to make an exception is Edward Norton. He melts into his roles so totally, it can be hard to recognize him from one film to the next. After playing a sociopathic murderer in Primal Fear, he moved to the cheerful singing boyfriend in Woody Allen's Everyone Says I Love You. And from there, a long list of great works by great directors, including American History X, Fight Club, and Spike Lee's 25th Hour. But movie making has changed over his quarter century as a leading man. Fight Club was shot over 130 days. That just doesn't happen anymore. The money's not there and the studios don't have the patience. Norton has tried his hand at directing twice, once on either side of that divide. He's just releasing his adaptation of the Jonathan Lethem novel Motherless Brooklyn. I'm in that one, and it's out November 1st. His other directing foray was in 2000 with a romantic comedy, Keeping the Faith.
I actually had more money and more time to make Keeping the Faith, a rabbi-priest joke turned into a romantic comedy, than I did to make Motherless Brooklyn, which is a big, epic New York
sweeping period piece
of the 50s done at scale with, you know, I think we ended up with 680-something effect shots in the film. I could have never made this film in the constraints of budget and time that we had back then, because I could barely pull off Keeping the Faith with more. And that was partly a function of, in the years since, you know, when we made The 25th Hour with Spike, which I think is one of his better films, which is saying a lot, he made that film in 26 days. Mm. And it's a really cinematically robust film shot in New York. Going through the training camp of seeing how he did that, seeing how Wes Anderson does his on fractional budgets and schedules, Iñárritu doing Birdman in 29 days.
What do they have in common?
Unbelievable planning. Just like planning at a level, rehearsal, engagement with actors in a way that necessitates less hand-holding and kind of debating on the day. Spike and Wes, they know what they want to do. They give themselves outs and things like that. They don't edit the film in the way they shoot it, but they are not making it up on the day. They have put a lot of thought into it, and they drive the proceedings along in a very determined way. And when you see really good people pull that off, if you take mental notes, you're like, wow, this can be done. This can be done in a different way. It can be done without compromise, and you can pull this off. I never, ever could have made this film without working with Spike, Wes, Alejandro, and others.
Did you know when you made Keeping the Faith, had you said to yourself over the past several years that you would do it again? Did you know you'd do it again?
I already had this one rattling around in my head, not unlike my character in this. My character, Lionel, says, let's just say an unfinished puzzle makes my head hurt worse than most people. That's as close to a line about myself as I've ever written. I'm also probably obstinate and don't like to be denied, but some of it is just that idea that he discusses in the film about having glass in the brain. If I get a thing in my head, I suffer a little bit from not achieving the satisfaction of ultimately like putting the story together and getting it told so I can get it out of my brain loop, you know. Part of my fascination with this piece was compulsion. The idea that, as Lionel says, you're doing something for certain reasons and at some point you even forget what the original reasons were. You're not even sure why you're still pressing on a thing.
Long after everyone's kind of glaring at you, like,
yeah.
Isn't it time, man, to bury
yeah.
that?
It's funny, isn't it, too, because there's things that are much more important in the world, and you can say to yourself, like, why am I applying so much of my time in life to telling a story. But at the same time, we're living in an age where a lot of things are encouraging people to be passive, you know, so pushing back against anything, that's just a good feeling. Mm.
Your dad was a federal prosecutor?
Yeah, at one point.
He was a U.S. attorney. He was a U.S. attorney, and your mom?
Most of my life taught high school English in a public school.
And your mom's dad was this very successful real estate developer?
Yeah, his name was Jim Rouse. He was very celebrated. He was on the cover of the New York Times when he died, which amazed me. And he was on the cover of Time Magazine. Like, when was the last time, for positive reasons, a real estate developer was on the cover of Time? He was considered one of the great visionaries of progressive humanistic ideas about cities. He achieved these very, very notable sort of downtown revitalization projects like the Baltimore Inner Harbor, sure, or Faneuil Hall in Boston,
right,
parts of the cities that had been written off, abandoned, and he saw vitality in them and was convinced that you could bring life back into cities, make cities the marketplace of ideas, culture, all of it.
Downtown.
And in many ways, he really decried, he was one of the first people to talk about sprawl, that highways were going to create low density development and that this was going to be, people were going to flee the cities and we were going to get kind of non-communities. We were going to get these sort of like limitless, and that the old world town was going to disappear in a way. And he was right. He proved these things he talked about in the 50s turned very true in the 60s and 70s. And so people really looked at him as a guru. But he developed kind of the first planned city in America, which was Columbia, Maryland, between Baltimore and Washington. Mm-hmm. It was very progressive, socioeconomically, ethnically diverse, lots of open space. It was kind of this utopian idea of what American communities could look like.
But what I want to get to is, I mean, you go to Yale and you go and you switch from astronomy.
So I studied history. I thought I wanted to study physics. I didn't have the math for it, mm-hmm, at all. Like, learned that very quickly, which was one of those good humbling moments. Realized I was like better at writing.
You switch to Asian history. You live in Japan. And did you work for your grandfather's company in Japan?
Yeah, I did. He was consulting to places that were trying to replicate what he had done with Inner Harbors and stuff. I wanted to live and work abroad, like in the Foreign Service or like the intelligence agencies used to recruit at Yale. And I was pretty enamored of like the idea of doing something and living overseas. But I had the bug. I kind of had the theater bug. And I kind of gave myself, I was like, I'm going to move to New York. And I couldn't really admit to myself I wanted to do that. You know,
neither could
that,
I.
Yeah,
actually.
I could. You're like doing this, you don't, there's something like.
There was an apology inside everything I did at the beginning.
Me too. And in some ways, it was because my grandfather, by then, had devoted all, his entire focus was on affordable housing development. And he had built one of the great organizations in America, a nonprofit organization, figuring out how to get complicated finance structures to get money into affordable housing development. And they were in New York redeveloping thousands of city-owned abandoned buildings across the late 80s and 90s. And I was working for him in New York. I literally went down, I was like 21, I went down, sat on the porch with my grandfather and sort of apologized to him because he paid for me to go to college. Yep. And I thought, how do I tell him? How do I tell him I want to be an actor, you know? And he was the greatest. He was a very eccentric, eclectic guy. He was orphaned when he was a kid. He never wore suits. He wore like Madras jackets and fishing hats. He was a genuine original. Yeah, he really was. And I was shocked. He said to me, he said, don't chase money. He said, whatever you do, just don't chase money. He said, just do what you love doing, what you have a passion for. And in good time, you'll figure out how you can be of service through it. You know, he said, you can be of service in anything. And he loved the arts. He helped create Center Stage at Baltimore by supporting it in the early years. He really believed in the arts. So he kind of gave me this permission. I was still working for him in New York. But then I started moonlighting in the theater and I felt like I was allowed.
But what I want to get to, I mean, I don't want to exaggerate this, but it's like, you know, you grow up, you go to Yale, and you come from a very, very stable family and a lot of successful people there. And my point is that in your acting, especially like bookending now and Primal Fear years ago, where you really, really start to take off in the movie business, are two damaged people.
Yeah. It's hard to say. You know, it's a funny thing because I'm not drawn to damage, but I am drawn to sort of the duality, like the idea of the layer you see and the layer you don't see, and sometimes they're paradoxical, you know? I think it's not by chance that, like, the Greek drama symbol is the two masks, the comedy and the drama masks, right? Because everybody's operating on these multiple levels. There's these levels in ourselves, and sometimes they coexist, and they're not necessarily antagonistic to each other, but they really are the yin to the yang, right? And I think that when you find when you find a character that the yin and the yang is going on, like, really clearly at the same time in them, that's interesting. And sometimes it's, I don't want to call it cheap, but sometimes it's like the kind of Primal Fear, like a person who's faking a thing that's sort of juicy. That's like the pulpy version of it. And it was a lot of fun, mm-hmm. right? Especially when no one knows who you are, so you can actually surprise a lot of people. Mm-hmm. But then sometimes if it's like American History X, that's not really a damaged person per se, but it's a person with this huge complexity going on. It is like Othello or something. He's a real leader. He's a lover of his family. He's got a real intellect. His potential is limitless, and he totally destroys himself with the one dark thing, with this rage, right? He's got rage, and the rage just dismantles everything else, right? And those paradoxes are sometimes really compelling.
Playing those parts, I watch you in this film, and I'm very drawn to the kind of acuity of that. Like, I need to believe underneath that there's a sensitive person.
Yeah.
You know, you're not just, it's not just externalized.
No, I think...
But you did a great job. I'm not just saying that because I'm in the film.
No, thank you. And I'm not just saying this because you're in the film and great in the film, but I think... It's a very interesting thing to me, like this idea of like the counterpoint in people, the capacities in people. And yeah, Lionel in this has Tourette's, but it's absolutely stolen from the book. Over Black at the top of the film, you hear his inner voice, right? Mm-hmm. So from the beginning, it's the trick of going, you're going to know me like a friend. I'm going to let you right in on the inside so that you can see the sensitive, smart person of depth of feeling, of loneliness, of longing. You're going to have immediate empathy because you're going to go, I like everything about the way this guy talks, the way he tells his own story. And then I'm going to let you in on the fact that I've got a really messed up condition that makes life very difficult, mm-hmm. very funny, etc. And that's a great dramatic trick because you're not 40 seconds in and you go, I'm on this guy's side. Right? And that's 100% credit to Jonathan Lethem, who wrote mm-hmm. the novel. That's how the novel works on page one.
And speaking of which, you walked around with the novel for how long?
I read the book, loved it, sort of got the rights to it, knew I couldn't work on it for a long time, and then got into this idea of taking this great character study of the book and grafting it into this kind of bigger idea. When I say bigger, I mean just that the plot of the novel is small and Byzantine. And I said to Jonathan, hey, what if we let Lionel, this great emotional relationship you create with the character, what if we let that be a vehicle into looking at something a little more cinematically grand, like the dark history of New York in the 50s? And he's a born and raised Brooklynite. He knew the heart of his novel was the character, and he loved the transposition, the idea of... Yeah, loved it.
No resistance whatsoever.
No, he's a real cinephile.
He got it.
Yeah, he got it. And also, we talked about how, you know, Chandler wrote multiple Marlowe detective stories, and it was like, let's take the great emotional connection you create in this character, and let's send him into his next mystery. Right? He loved that idea. And thank God Jonathan's not only a secure as an artist, but he understands that in going to film, you're going into another medium. You need something different.
It's like I would do a part in a film. I'll never forget. We do the movie Pearl Harbor, and Doolittle, of the famous aviator,
Jimmy Doolittle.
I play him in the film, and we're there shooting in L.A. one day, and members of his family are there, like his granddaughter, and they're involved in some foundation or something that keeps the flame alive of the Doolittle memory. And I forget what the organization was, but this is back in 2000, we shoot this movie. Big sunny day, we're there shooting at, I forget where we were, and I walk up to them and I go, so how's it going? You're enjoying watching the movie? And she goes, yes, but Granddad would never do that. He would never talk to people that way, the way you're doing that. And I was on the tip of my tongue. I want to go, and this is true of men who had to be built a certain way to fit into the cockpits of those planes. Right. They were all little bantams. And I wanted to say, you know, if we really were going after the whole granddad thing, Bob Balaban would be playing your granddad right now, not me. I'm about, you know, 60 pounds heavier than your granddad, and at least. So now I don't want to meet the people. I don't want to know the people. I'm going to go in there. My point is that when you said about Lethem in the book, well, I'll say to someone, the character in the film represents an idea in the film. We're not telling some story about them.
No, I felt that way about your character. Some people have said to me, well, clearly it's based on Robert Moses. And you don't want to contend with that because, yes, it's infused with Robert Moses, but it is also, there's a reason I didn't pretend that these made-up characters of Motherless Brooklyn were interacting with real historical figures, because then you end up answering all these ridiculous questions about it's like, well, wait, did Robert Moses really do that? Is that really true? Did this and that really happen? You go, you know, this is why the wisdom to me in, you could go back, Citizen Kane is about, it's Charles Foster Kane. It's not William Randolph Hearst. And yes, it is. The essence of it is distilled, but as you know, when you read about that, they infused quite a few details in that story from other people's lives as well to create an essential American character, right? And Robert Penn Warren's great book, All the King's Men, it's about Huey Long, but it's not about Huey Long. It's a made-up story. That's why he made it Willie Stark.
The platform.
And to me, without revealing where we know this film goes in the end, there's a huge amount that happens in this movie that has nothing to do whatsoever with anything that happened in Robert Moses' life on a plotting level, on a psychosexual level, all kinds of stuff. So there's distillations of the type of person he was. There's also a weave of everything from Strom Thurmond and other, there's people that had details of their lives that inspired me to kind of go, I want to distill this into the essence of a type of person that we as Americans have to really think about how much of them we're willing to tolerate.
And when he saw the movie, what kind of reaction did you get?
That was one of my most nervous days.
Right, of course.
There was like the day when you showed up on set and I'm like, will he know his lines? No, I'm kidding.
I did the best I can with what I have.
Showing it to Lethem, I was nervous.
And how'd it go?
He was great. He was very, very emotional about it. It was very gratifying. For him, I think it was... You know, it's like you've done a thing, and then the thing has refracted and become a whole other thing. And I think he was artistically really thrilled.
When you had the book, over the arc of the time you had the book, was there a moment you threw in the towel and said, I don't think I'm going to do it?
I had a couple of moments of feeling like I was Don Quixote and tilting at windmills. And you know well, because we have kids who are the same age and stuff. You get into this chapter of your life and you just say, how much am I willing to bend our lives around a mirage, right? Like, am I going to keep us on the camels going toward the mirage? Am I going to not do other work? Am I going to like say, no, we can't take that trip because there's a possibility that this might come together? You know, it starts to get into a real like life priorities.
Well, as my friend said, when passion crosses over into neurosis.
Yeah, or ego, or but I think, you know, Joe, I mean, I really think, and I'm not flipping around on you, but you've said to me, I'm doing this thing on Saturday nights as if it can't coexist with the you that we all came up on. I saw you in Streetcar
doing
on Broadway.
Straight drama, yeah.
Yeah, Glengarry, Glenn Ross, these things that became, for us, really iconic moments of what I'd call like the, dark weighty thing. Miami Blues, which I was always a big fan of. But to me, this notion that just because you're functioning in a certain gear, let's call it the smiley half of the Greek mask, that the other thing doesn't coexist, right, and that it's not more interesting because it coexists. That's the thing is, to me, it's like, it's not even that they cancel each other out. It's that they become more interesting when they're both there, right? Because that's more true. There's a lot of dark stuff going on under a lot of people's smiley narratives, right? To me, one of your most interesting sessions in here was the one you put up after it all broke, the Schneiderman podcast you did. And Eric, I thought the way you led that in with, hey, we've had these conversations with someone, we've had a conversation in a gear that is, we're connecting with a conscious, humanist, progressive.
He was a hero
thing.
Of mine.
Yeah. And then there's this thing going on, unseen by almost anybody, right? That's so dark. And you just constantly forced, I think, to grasp this idea of there's a narrative in American life and in our lives individually, and then there's the shadow narrative, this thing that's going on underneath it. And it's very, very rare that we find ways into having honest conversations about how we integrate those two things, right? Because that's like the argument. It's the argument inside ourselves privately. You think about anyone we know who we know has a measure of quality, an admirable quality as a human being, and he's doing stuff that is either, you know, detestable, unforgivable, whatever. We know that person's having an argument inside themselves, right? We're having that argument as a country. Yes. We're having to say to ourselves, hey, we have to be able to hold the ideal. We have to be able to still take pride in our engagement with the ideal, but we absolutely have to confront the shadow narrative. We have to be honest about what we are doing that's antagonistic to what we're saying.
That was movie star, director, producer Edward Norton, another great actor whose career spans the then and now of old school movies and streaming television is Michael Douglas.
You know, if I get one more drunken guy from the street go, hey, man, Greed is good. You're the man. You're why I got into this business and everything. I go, hey, you know,
that's what I
was a villain.
The rest of my interview with Michael Douglas is in our archive at heresthething.org. Ed Norton on his favorite directors coming up next. I'm Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing. To keep up with the next part of the show, here's what you need to know about some of Edward Norton's movies. Fight Club was directed by David Fincher. American History X was directed by Tony Kaye, who took out full-page ads in Variety, complaining he'd been knifed in the back after the studio gave Norton final cut on the film. And The People vs. Larry Flint was directed by one of Norton's heroes, the late Miloš Forman, born in communist Czechoslovakia.
You know, he came out from behind the Iron Curtain and landed in America and then made these definitive films about individual spirit pushing back against oppression, right? Cuckoo's Nest and Ragtime and Amadeus. And he just made like film after film after film that, you know, they set the bar very high. They were like, wow, you can take things that no one would call a traditional commercial story and make these great pieces of art out of them. And the thing was, I came to him having made very few films, and I still kind of considered myself more of a, you know, my life had been in theater. The funny thing is, the first two films I did, we did kind of do them in a way where we made the scenes work in the room, right? They worked in the room, and Woody Allen shoots a lot of single takes, mm-hmm. So it works as one. I got on there with Miloš and realized that he would shoot in this very open-ended, improvisational way. He would let things change and shift, and then he wouldn't cover it from the other side. And I started to get this anxiety, like, he would say, great, you know, let's move. And I would say, but nothing happened. Like, we never got anything. it didn't work. The scene was never played. And he would kind of look at me like, what do you think this is? This is, you know, he said, this is not, we're not doing play. He said to me one time, he goes, I am a man with a pickaxe and there's a cliff and I must take the clay from the cliff. I'm not making sculpture. I make sculpture later, you know? And I was thinking, I might be on the first Miloš Forman film where he has lost the plot completely. I'm going to be in the first really bad Miloš Forman film, because I would see him move on from things. I could not for the life of me think how he was finished. And I happened to have free time, and he let me in on the editing process, just not to be, just to literally, I would bring him coffee. I'm not kidding. Just to watch. And I began to realize that he was a master of casting and one of the greatest editors ever. He would take things that had never happened and create scenes out of raw material that had never occurred. And it was this enormous awakening to the plasticity of film. I realized that when you're an actor, you're just giving a director raw material to work with, and you have to, hopefully you trust them in a devotional way, because you are surrendering clay to them. And I remember Mike Nichols saying the reason he loved Jeremy Irons was that if he had a bad idea, he knew that Jeremy Irons would give it the full force of his talent so that he could get off the bad idea, because he would say to himself, Jeremy gives me everything, and if he can't make it work, then I know it's a bad idea, right? And that was very profound, because I think obviously we all get into situations where maybe there isn't trust, and so we defend, we protect, we resist, right?
Shut down.
Yeah, we shut down. But in that happy circumstance, when you're with in a trusting relationship, you serve. You really do just serve. And if the guy says, you know, when we were doing Birdman, Inarritu would sometimes come in and go, guys, it's got to be, you know, this, it's too white, it has to be black, you know, and we would do black for a while. And then he would come back and he would say, no, guys, what are you doing? It's all black. I was telling you it has to be white.
When I said black, what I meant
was the other, you know. And you realize he's having a conversation with himself, not with you. And that what you have to do is serve the debate he's having with himself and give him whatever he needs. It's kind of a happy place to be when it's going like that, right? But
Fincher.
Well, he's more talented across more divisions of filmmaking than anyone I've worked with. Yeah, he's as great a cinematographer as any cinematographer. He's a great editor. He's annoyingly great with a line reading. You know what I mean? He's funny. And sometimes you have one of those moments, like it was sort of the like, hey, you know, you're feeling each other out. And at some point on that movie, I was like, I was running in wingtips and underwear, and I was maybe I was probably leaning into the farce of it a little bit too much, maybe. Anyway, he comes over and he just goes, a little less Jerry, a little more Dean.
Right. That's a great line.
And that was, yeah. And I instantly was like, that's all we have to say, the rest of this movie. That's the key to the whole movie.
Yeah.
I want to say this about Fincher, because right, it had a big impact on making Motherless Brooklyn. There are times when being a director requires a certain amount of almost sociopathic lack of empathy for other people's stresses. There are many demands. Money's going out the door. Time is running down.
Yeah.
And you feel stress in other people. There's no way that won't happen. And one of the things I learned, with not a shred of sarcasm in this, about was that Fincher was amazing at facing down the stresses of others in defense of the aesthetic value that he,
I know what I need,
knows. And there were many, many times, even within this massive 130-day shoot, where Fincher, you know, famously he does a lot of takes. Early on, I decided, I already know this about him. Whatever it is that he's chasing, I have seen the result in his films. They have a hypnotic visual elegance that I have not seen equaled.
Yeah.
And so whatever he takes, if he needs 35, I have to find the way to stay in gear for 35, right? But I would say one of the things I observed watching him, and nobody is him, but you do realize that when he says, we're not done because a move of the camera where it bumps in the middle that everyone else says, that doesn't matter. He knows it matters. And there are times when you have to say to everyone else who thinks you're done, we're not done. You have to see the portrait of what a person looks like who's standing firm within reason. You know what I mean?
So, Tony Kaye. Now, I only asked, obviously, that was a contentious thing. Everybody talks about how that was a tough set and everything. But did he help you as an actor at all?
No, but see, here, this is interesting, and I don't want to sideline on it too much. But I think, you know, you kind of hinted at it, but we're living in this age where clickbait journalism likes to create headlines. And before it was even clickbait, entertainment press was doing their version of it. People like to manufacture antagonism because it sounds like a good story, whether or not it in fact existed. So the very fact that even down the chain of it all, what's come to your head is that it was a tough set, right? That's what you just said. There's not a shred of truth in it.
Right,
not a shred
perfect.
Of truth. We worked synergistically. Tony is a great photographer. He lit and shot and operated the film himself. And he had a great gift for a visual sensibility and what I would call a very pure meter for just a kind of a gutsy, visceral thing. He never professed to a shred of experience with or even, I don't want to say interest in, he did not want to control narrative, right? My friend David McKenna, and then with me, we had worked on that script for a long time. And he ceded that to us. He was like, you guys are good at this. I know what to do with it, blah, blah, blah. And we worked hand in glove together through a very vital, very guerrilla kind of a shoot. There was many, many, many times throughout where—
Great film.
Yeah, we had truly lovely moments together. I remember Tony, he's very emotive. And one time he cried and hugged me and said, I've never felt so supported. I've never had a collaborative experience like this. And I felt the same. I thought he was a very intuitive thing. What went on turned into this thing as if it was about me and him. He got into, I would call it a fear of release. He cared a lot, and he had a really difficult time finishing things.
Mm-hmm. I'm bringing up that in spite of what people had said,
yes,
you can tell.
No, that's why I'm saying it.
You can't make a film like that and not have some battery with the
director.
And I
know for a fact he's told people he's very proud of it in the end.
It's a great film.
I think people want to distill some sort of a negativity into situations that are complex. And I think, you know this too.
I feel you, brother. I feel you.
You know this. But the funny thing is what's strange about it to me is work on things done with passion is going to produce people contending with each other, right? Ideas are going to bump up against each other and burnish each other. They're going to test each other and they will refine the thing. People get through those experiences together and generally shake hands and thank each other for the work. It's not about you. It's not about the ego. It's not about the thing. It's like, this is how we do the thing that makes it good. And most people come out the back, most people who know what they're doing come out the backside of that and celebrate that in each other. And then other people turn it into some BS argument.
Well, let me say two more things. One is that, I tell young actors, I say, one of the worst traps you can fall in is that time goes by and you work with anemic directors and you work with directors who don't offer you much in film and television. And you become, as we must, self-directing. Not that you've steeled yourself against collaborating with a good director, you forgot how. You've forgotten how to do it. Mm. So you come, and the worst thing that can happen to you is you have a good director who wants to work with you and shape you.
And then you're tight.
And you don't let him in. You don't know how to let him in.
Right. No, I think that's very true. The opposite is, if there's a situation you can smell now through experience is going to lead to situations where, then stay away from it. You know what I mean? Then say no. Don't get sucked in. And also build your own tribe. You know, that's to me a big part of the appeal of directing is honestly, like, I don't know if you feel this, but you had 30 Rock, which to me is like, that's that repertory. It's like having your own repertory company, right? It's something very special.
I think
all actors in some part of themselves want that. They want, it's that dream of being part of a troupe, right? People, you know, it's like in Wes's, in Rushmore, right. The Max Fisher players. We all want to be in the Max Fisher players, you know what I mean?
You are in the Max Fisher player.
And by the way, that's why a lot of us will show up and do small parts when it's our turn to have a small part or a bigger part. It doesn't matter because you're in the troupe, and it's a wonderful place to be. Like, it really is. I've often felt like, you know, you look at the Coens or people who have these long-term alliances. Sometimes I always thought, like, I'd like the pleasure of that. But one of the things about directing is you get to create your troupe. Like, people talk about Orson Welles, they forget the guy was a kid. He was 25 years old when he made that film. And what did he do? He took all of the Mercury Theater players from his RKO radio days and his WP, and he pulled them into
the
film.
Right.
Agnes Moorehead, all these people you never heard of, and they're amazing, right? And for me, Motherless Brooklyn, I would say honestly one of the greatest joys of it was I looked at my roster of New York theater actors that I've known in many cases for 20 years, 25 years, done plays at the 29th Street Rep with, done plays, and said, I know that guy's great. I know she's great. I know Alex great. Willem's great. These are my people that I've already got shorthand with, and I'm going to pull them together and make a effing ensemble of the actors I get on with and love. And it was pure pleasure for me, even among the stresses.
Who's the person on the set, off the set, anywhere in the whole configuration who's helping you protect your performance? I directed a film once. I hated the experience. And the person that was most underserved acting-wise
was you.
Was me. How did you prevent against that? Who was your voice?
I mean, most permanent, my partner, Bill Migliore, who he and I met as
he
actors.
He helped you in that way?
We met as actors, and he's a terrific actor. He's my producer on this film.
And he
film.
Helped you keep an eye on that?
Absolutely. Like, he's just a trusted, you know, you glance over, a little bit of a nod, a little bit of a shake of the head, like, I'm not
One
really
more.
Sure. Yeah, like, you know, or that there's that. I trusted Dick Pope, my great cinematographer.
So you had help, some eyes
You
on.
Know, yeah, there's, he, things. And honestly, I mentioned, there's a guy, the guy who plays the mayor, who you, you know, steamroll right at the beginning of the film. Peter Lewis is a actor I worked with when I was 24 in New York on the stage, and he's a terrific actor, and he's a teacher. He's an acting teacher. And I rehearsed my part with him, doing the scenes with you, doing the scenes with Willem, just to give myself some time with someone who I like their instincts, I like their meter, to kind of get my own rhythm, you know, going on it and stuff like that. But there's dimensions of directing a thing that you're in that are not great for the best of the experience between actors, because you're ruining it on some level. On the other hand, though, when you have the type of people I had, what I loved about it was I love that feeling of like of a company. Like, it's what when we all read about Welles and his guys, the fantasy is that we're all in it together, you know, and on this film, God bless every actor in it. Everyone did it for me for no money because they believed in the piece, believed in me.
I told you, I would have done it for a lot less money.
You're the only person I've ever known who said, pay me less. There's something when you can feel the weight of people's conviction. That's what I was going for.
You did a great job.
It was a completely thrilling and fulfilling experience.
Great actor, now great director, Edward Norton. There were a lot of movie titles and directors' names coming at you fast in this episode. If you'd like a list of the films Edward Norton and I discussed, text THING to 70101. That's THING to 70101. Motherless Brooklyn is out November 1st. I'm Alec Baldwin. Here's the Thing is a production of WNYC Studios.